Whenever we talk about the Middle Ages, specifically medieval philosophy, there's this very specific, very safe vibe that comes to
Oh,
mind.
definitely. The classic Dark Ages trope.
Right, exactly. You picture these guys in rough wool robes sitting in drafty stone rooms.
Just quietly copying ancient texts by candlelight.
Yeah, it feels obedient, like it's totally static.
Like everyone was just nodding along to whatever the church said, or.
Exactly. The assumption is that everyone was asleep at the wheel until the Renaissance showed up and finally turned the lights back on.
But that entire era was definitely not an intellectual hibernation.
No, not at all. And we have a stack of sources here today for this deep dive: articles, historical analyses, some pretty dense theological notes that paint a completely different picture.
A radically different picture.
We are looking at the late 13th and early 14th centuries, and let me tell you, it wasn't a quiet library. It looks more like a demolition site.
That is a much better analogy. It was
Yeah.
an absolute battlefield of ideas.
So our mission today is diving into the work of two specific rebels, I guess you would call them, Duns Scotus, the subtle doctor, and William of Ockham.
Two monumental figures.
And from what I'm reading in these sources, these guys didn't just tweak the operating system of the Western world, they took a sledgehammer to the hard drive.
They really did.
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing is, and we should be clear about this, they didn't do it because they were atheists or modern
Oh,
rebels.
right. They were devout.
Incredibly devout. They did it because they thought the status quo theology of the time was actually insulting to God.
Which is wild. So this is effectively a deep dive into the birth of the modern mind. We're going to find out how a debate about God's will ended up basically accidentally inventing the scientific method.
It's a classic case of unintended consequences. You pull a thread in 14th century theology, and 3 centuries later, you unravel the entire fabric of
Okay,
physics.
so let's set the board for everyone listening. Is the universe a necessary machine that couldn't be otherwise, or is it the result of a free choice? That's the core question here.
That is the exact tension.
Before Scotus and Ockham show up with their sledgehammers, what does the world look like? What was the dominant operating system that they were so angry about?
Well, to understand that, you have to look at the synthesis created by Thomas Aquinas.
Right, the big guy.
Yeah. A few decades before our guys show up, Aquinas had successfully merged Christian theology with the philosophy of Aristotle.
And the key word in the sources for this system is intellectualism,
Yes. Intellectualism.
which, I mean, usually sounds like a compliment, like, oh, he's an intellectual. But in this context, it's a highly technical term.
Right. It's not about being smart. It refers to the priority of the intellect over the will.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure, Aquinas argued that God's intellect is primary. So God acts according to eternal forms, eternal logic, and blueprints that exist necessarily.
Meaning God isn't just winging it.
Exactly. So in the Aquinas view, the universe is a rational, orderly hierarchy. It's what they called the great chain of being.
I remember this graphic from school. You have rocks at the bottom, then plants, then animals, humans, angels, and finally God at the top.
But it's important to realize it's not just a list, it's a ladder of necessity.
Ontological necessity, yeah.
Yes, Aquinas saw this hierarchy as fixed. Because God is perfect reason and he acts according to perfect logic, he created the best possible world. Everything fits together like a puzzle.
No gaps.
No gaps. Nothing is arbitrary. Everything has its specific, necessary place.
So if I'm understanding the implication here, and this is what bugs SCOTUS so much,
Right.
if the universe had to be this way because it's the logical way, and God had to create it this way because he's perfectly rational, is God actually free?
That is the exact question Duns Scotus asked. He looked at this Greek determinism that had crept in via Aristotle and basically said, wait a minute.
It puts God in a box.
Completely. If God is bound by some external logic or these eternal forms that dictate how he creates, then God isn't truly sovereign. He's just a manager executing a plan he didn't really choose.
And that's where the rebellion starts. This is the shift from intellectualism to voluntarism.
Precisely. Voluntarism comes from the Latin voluntas, meaning will.
So stressing the primacy of the will over the intellect.
Right. Scotus, and later Ockham, argued that the will is primary. They believe God isn't a computer running a logic program. He is a radically free agent.
He could have made the world completely differently if he wanted to.
Yes. The universe isn't a necessary machine. It's a choice.
It's contingent. That's the buzzword for this entire deep dive. Contingency.
Contingency.
Yeah.
It simply means it could have been otherwise.
Okay, so SCOTUS wants to prove that the world is contingent, not necessary. How does he actually break that great chain of being? Because that hierarchy seems pretty solidly built. It was the standard model for centuries.
He does it by introducing a concept that, I'll be honest, is notoriously difficult to grasp at first. It's called the univocity of being.
Yeah, I saw this in the notes. Aquinas held to the analogy of being, and SCOTUS flips it to univocity. Can you break that down for us without getting too bogged down in the Latin?
I'll try. Think of it this way. Aquinas thought that when we say God exists and a rock exists, we're using the word exist in two totally different ways.
Because God is infinite and the rock is a rock.
Exactly. God has infinite existence and the rock has a tiny derivative slice of existence. They are on that ladder we talked about. There's a massive qualitative gap between them.
So they're in different categories entirely, like comparing the concept of justice to a ham sandwich.
That's a great way to put it. But SCOTUS disagrees. He shifts to univocity, univocal one voice or one meaning.
Okay.
He says, look, being existence itself is binary. It's like a light switch.
You either exist or you don't.
Exactly. Something either is or it isn't. You can't sort of exist. You can't exist more than something else.
Wait, so he's leveling the playing field?
In metaphysical sense, yes. He argues that the concept of being means the exact same thing when applied to God as it does when applied to a human or a rock.
That feels incredibly radical for the 1300s.
It just means isness. Obviously, God is infinite and we are finite. SCOTUS isn't saying we are equal to God.
Right, right. But the fact that we exist is the same kind of fact.
So if existence is just a flat yes or no state, then that vertical ladder of Aquinas, where you climb closer to God by having more being, it just collapses.
It completely shatters the hierarchy. There are no longer degrees of existence.
Wow.
And suddenly, the universe isn't this necessary structure where everything has a fixed rank determined by its form. It's just a collection of individual things that God freely chose to click the on switch for.
It makes everything feel much more immediate. Which actually brings us to the next big shift. How we know things.
Yes, the mental act.
Because if the hierarchy is gone, does that change the relationship between the mind and reality?
It changes everything. Under the old system, God knew you because he knew the concept of humanity.
Like an archetype.
Right. He looked at the perfect blueprint of human in his mind, and you were just a copy of that blueprint. Knowledge was about universals.
So in the old view, I'm just an instance of a file type. I'm like,
right.
Human underscore V1 underscore final dot doc. Essentially, yes, your printout. But SCOTUS says, because of univocity, because we share this common in Bluth, as now, God doesn't need to look at a blueprint.
He knows us directly.
He knows you directly as you are. He knows this specific entity. He knows the particular, not just the universal.
And SCOTUS extends this direct knowledge to human minds too, right? This is the section in the sources on intentionality.
Yes. And this is one of Scobus's most brilliant contributions. It actually anticipates modern philosophy like 20th century phenomenology, thinkers like Brentano and Husserl, by centuries.
Because he was worried about what we now call anti-realism.
Exactly. The fear that we are trapped inside our own subjective heads. If our minds only work with concepts and mental images, how do we know the real world is actually out there?
Right. If I'm just looking at a picture of a tree in my head, how do I know there's a real tree outside? I could be a brain in a vat.
Or stuck in the matrix.
Yeah.
SCOTUS solves this with intentionality. He defines thought not as having a picture in your head, but as an act of external reference. It's an act of pointing.
So when you think of a tree, your mind is pointing outside of itself to a reality.
Yes. Your mind isn't a container of images.
It's a spotlight.
That's a perfect analogy. It's a direct link to reality. SCOTUS is saying, we aren't trapped in our heads. We can have direct awareness of reality just as God has direct awareness of particulars.
Speaking of particulars and distinct things, this leads to, honestly, my favorite term in this entire research packet. Hicetus.
Hicetus.
I mean, it sounds like a sneeze, but the concept is profound. The science of thisness.
Thisness, yes. It's the answer to the problem of individuation.
Basically answering the question, what makes me me? What makes me an individual and not you?
Right. And this was a huge debate. Aristotle and Aquinas said that matter is what individuates us.
Matter and form, right?
Yes. We all share the same form of humanity, like we're all cookies cut from the same exact cookie cutter.
Okay.
The only thing that makes us different is that I'm this specific chunk of dough and you're that chunk of dough.
Which is kind of depressing when you think about it. It means my personality, my core identity, is just a byproduct of my meat suit. I'm just a generic human who happens to be occupying this physical space.
SCOTUS hated that answer, and he pointed out a massive logical hole in it. What about angels?
Oh, right. Because in theology, angels are spirits. They don't have bodies.
Precisely. They don't have matter. So if matter is the only thing that separates individuals, then logically you can't have two different angels.
They would all just be one big generic angel form.
But everyone in the Middle Ages agreed there are individual angels. You have Gabriel, Michael, Raphael. They aren't clones.
So matter can't be the answer to what makes us individuals.
SCOTUS says there must be a third principle. You have form, you have matter, and then you have haesitus.
A unique thisness.
A unique thisness that God specifically creates. It's the specific principle of individuality. You aren't just humanity or a body. You are this specific person.
I can really see why the later humanists like this idea so much. It grants so much positive value to the individual.
It absolutely does.
I'm not just a flawed copy of a perfect archetype. I have a unique identity directly created and known by God.
And importantly, this grounds the freedom of the individual will. If you are just a generic product of matter, your choices would just be generic, determined reactions. But if you have a unique identity, you have true agency.
So let's just take stock for a second. We've got a contingent universe. It didn't have to be this way. We have direct contact with reality through intentionality. And we have the dignity of the individual via thisness.
It all sounds very freeing.
It sounds great. But then we get to the fallout in the sources.
The fallout is, well, it's significant.
Because if the world is contingent, if God could have arranged creation differently, what does that do to logic and ethics?
It creates a massive problem for the armchair philosopher.
How so?
In the old view, you could use pure logic syllogisms to figure out the universe, because the universe was built on necessary logic.
Like, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man.
Therefore, Socrates is mortal. You can figure that out with absolute certainty without ever leaving your house. But if God can change the rules, if the world is contingent, then logical deduction only gives you probability.
Not absolute certainty.
Exactly. You can't just sit in your room and think about how the universe should work. You have to actually go outside and look at the particulars to know the truth. You have to see how God actually decided to make it work.
You have to, like, count the teeth in the horse's mouth. You can't just logically deduce how many teeth a horse ought to have.
Yes. SCOTUS is pushing us heavily toward empiricism here. But the ethical implications are even wilder. This brings us to divine command theory.
And this is the part that might make some of you listening a bit uncomfortable, because usually we like the idea of natural law.
The idea that good and evil are built into the fabric of the universe.
Like gravity. It's just a fact of reality.
Aquinas loved natural law. He thought the moral law was a necessary reflection of the eternal structure of reality. But SCOTUS says, hold on, if the universe's order is contingent on God's free choice, then the moral law depends on his free choice, too.
Meaning God could change the definition of good.
To an extent. SCOTUS makes a very subtle distinction here. He is the subtle doctor, after all. He looks at the Ten Commandments.
Okay, the Big Ten.
He says the first three, don't worship other gods, don't take the Lord's name in vain. Those are unchangeable.
Because they deal with our relationship to God.
Right. They reflect God's own nature, which doesn't change. God can't command us to hate him, because that contradicts his nature.
Okay, so those first three are bedrock. But what about the last seven? Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery.
SCOTUS argues those are contingent.
Wow.
They govern relationships between people and things. And since God created humans and the world freely, he can regulate those relationships however he sees fit.
You know, this explains a lot of the weird stuff in the source material from the Old Testament.
It's the only way to explain it logically under this system. Take Abraham and Isaac.
Where God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son.
Right. If do not kill is a logical, necessary, absolute, like 2 + 2 = 4, then God is commanding a logical contradiction.
He's being irrational.
But if do not kill is just a rule God chose for our human relations,
then the lawgiver can make an exception. He can suspend the rule for a specific situation.
Same with polygamy in the ancient texts.
Yeah.
God can change the rules for human interaction because those relations aren't logically necessary.
It shifts morality entirely. It goes from aligning with cosmic geometry to obedience to a person.
It does. And when divine command is silent on an issue, SCOTUS says we use right reason.
Which is what?
It tends to be prudential. We have to weigh consequences in specific situations. We aren't just looking at a static form of the good anymore.
Okay, so SCOTUS has loosened the jar, he's made the world contingent, focused on the individual, and made ethics a matter of will. But now we have to introduce the guy who takes the lid off the jar and throws it out the window entirely.
William of Ockham.
William Ockham.
If SCOTUS was a reformer, Ockham was a revolutionary. He looks at SCOTUS's system and basically says, you didn't go far enough.
This is where we get the destruction of the synthesis, nominalism, or terminalism, as it's sometimes called.
Right. SCOTUS still believed that while individuals are unique, they do share a common nature, like we all share humanness.
Ockham pulls out his famous razor, I assume.
He does. He cuts that common nature out completely. Yeah. He rejects universals entirely. He says there is no such thing as humanness.
None at all.
No, only individual humans exist. Tom, Dick, and Harry are real. The universal category man is not real.
So what are we doing when we speak? If I say the word dog, I'm using a category. If categories aren't real, am I just making meaningless noise?
Well, some earlier thinkers thought that they called it flatus vocis, voice wind. But Ockham had to account for language.
Right, because we clearly communicate.
He rejected the idea that a term refers to a vague mental image, like a stick figure representing all humans. He disliked that because it meant indirect knowledge. A picture of a Great Dane doesn't look anything like a Chihuahua.
So he goes back to SCOTUS's mental act, the intentionality thing.
Yes, but he radicalizes it. He says a term refers to the mental act of pointing. When we use a universal term like human, we aren't referencing a shared nature that actually exists out there.
What are we doing then?
We are engaging in a mental act of pointing to every individual human simultaneously. We are grouping them.
So the universal is literally just a label, a name, a nomen.
Hence, nominalism. It's a tagging system we invented to organize the world. It has no reality outside of our minds.
Like a constellation.
Perfect example. The stars are real, but the Big Dipper is just a picture we decided to draw between them. Ockham says everything is like that.
I mean, this sounds like semantic hair splitting at first, but the sources imply this destroys the medieval worldview entirely. Why is Ockham's view so destructive to the mechanics of the universe?
Because by removing universals and forms, he removed final causes from nature. Teleology.
Unpack that for us. Teleology is the idea that things have built-in purposes or goals, right?
All right. In the old Aristotelian view, an acorn grows into an oak tree because it has the form of an oak tree inside it, literally pulling it toward its purpose. The final cause of the acorn is the tree. Nature was filled with goals.
But if Ockham says oak tree-ness doesn't exist,
then the acorn has no internal purpose. It has no goal.
So why does it grow?
Line forces. Well, what they call material causes and efficient causes.
Yeah.
Bodies and forces.
Stuff and energy.
Exactly. We stop asking, what is the purpose of this form? And we start asking, how does this force move this body?
Wow. Okay, I see it now. That is literally the transition to modern science.
It is the conceptual construction site for Isaac Newton. Ockham clears away the mystical forms and purposes and leaves us with just matter in motion, governed by God's arbitrary laws.
It's so ironic, because Ockham was a devout Franciscan. He did this to elevate God's power, to say God isn't bound by nature's purposes.
Right.
But in doing so, he kind of stripped nature of its inherent spiritual meaning.
He created a bifurcated world. On one side, you have faith, which is now just about obeying God's arbitrary will. On the other side, you have science, which is just measuring the mechanical movement of bodies. The bridge between them is gone.
The great chain of being is completely gone.
Exactly. And honestly, this is the world we live in today. We don't look for the moral purpose of a virus or a tectonic plate shifting.
We look for the mechanism. We ask how, not why.
That is Ockham's true legacy, opening the door to empiricism and the scientific revolution.
It really challenges that whole idea we started with, that the Middle Ages were just stagnant, this massive shift from intellect to will, from a necessary hierarchy to contingent individuals, from purpose to mechanism. It all happened inside the theology departments.
We are, in so many ways, the children of this medieval debate. We value the individual above the collective. We trust empirical science over abstract logic, and we tend to view morality as a matter of will or social agreement.
Which actually brings me to the final thought I want to leave everyone listening with today. We mentioned the unintended consequences of this shift.
Oh, this is a big one. Go on.
If Ockham is right, if there are no universal natures, if humanness is just a convenient label we invented to group distinct individuals together, then what happens to human rights?
That is the dangerous question, isn't it?
We love to say rights are inalienable and universal. We say they belong to us simply by virtue of our shared humanity. But if humanity doesn't actually exist as a real, objective thing, if it's just a name, then aren't human rights just a name, too?
It's a profound problem. If you lose the universal form, do you lose the universal protection? If rights aren't built into the fundamental fabric of reality, then they are just a contract we've made with each other.
And contracts can be broken or rewritten.
It's a haunting reflection on the loss of universal forms. Maybe the chain of being was restrictive, but it certainly provided a solid, unshakable foundation.
And we've been trying to find a new foundation ever since. Well, on that cheerful, incredibly provocative note, we'll wrap up this deep dive. It's been a wild ride from medieval monks to modern mechanics. Thanks for walking us through the demolition site.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
See you all next time. Keep questioning the consensus.